Ireland is one of the most amazing nations in the 21st century. In fact, you'd be surprised to know that the entire size of the country is 4 times lesser than Mumbai. Nonetheless, it is one of the fastest growing nations in the world. But this wasn't the case in the 1980s. The country was one of the worst performing nations in the world with an unemployment rate of more than 20% and inflation was soaring at 18.2%. In fact, the condition of Ireland was so bad that a major chunk of the population started leaving the country. This is exactly when the Irish government got together and decided to make an investment, and this exact investment started paying off 25 years later. The question is, what is this investment and more importantly, what can we learn from Ireland? Starting from the 1980s, Ireland started investing heavily and strategically onto higher education. The kernel word here, guys, is not heavily but strategically. The government invested itself onto market research to try and understand what kind of skills will be in high demand in the international market, and this is exactly when companies like Apple were still in its nascent stages. So what did they do? They built something called as regional technical colleges. And along with that, they also started building universities to train the youth in specific programs like electrical engineering and information technology. The key highlight over here is that these universities were built after making sure that there is a pipeline of employment opportunities with companies like Apple, Microsoft, and other Silicon Valley firms. Fast forward to 1993. Because of these universities, the share of science and technical graduates in the labor force in Ireland was the highest among the 25 OECD countries. On top of that, they also ensured that children are made proficient in at least 2 foreign languages, just so that they could be prepared for a wider scope of opportunities in the international market. And guess what? Slowly and steadily, over the period of 1991 to 1996, people who fled the country started coming back. My guest on the show today is also very well known for making these strategic decisions that stick over time because he understands that a company is a for-profit expression of the intellect and therefore invests his time strategically onto 3 different aspects: the people, the technology, and the products. Having worked with him closely, I've learned how to make decisions based on data and be unemotional during the process. One of the very few leaders who loves to be in the trenches, he gets his hands dirty and walks the talk around topics of innovation and product building. In a world where everybody is focused on building AI applications, he is on a mission to secure them. I welcome Manoj Kumar Parmar to our show. Hi Manoj, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Sharad. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're very loud and clear. So I think without much further ado, we can get started.
Sure.
Welcome to the Elbow Grease podcast. So the last couple of years, they've been really tough. So I really want to start with one of the most important questions about, you know, how do you manage your time, your energy level? How has your life been over the last 7 to 8 months?
Okay. First of all, Sharad, thank you for inviting. And it's a pleasure to join you here. I must say that the life in general during the pandemic was tough from many friends. Taking up this new challenge and working on this challenge has given up in a lot of new dimensions to think, as well as manage multiple perspectives and aspects. So it was challenging, but at the same time, it was fulfilling. So that's how I will briefly summarize in the life that is about in 7 to 8 months. And as we go on, I think there will be some anecdotes that will come in, which you will be able to relate to.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I really manage 3 different aspects. One is the energy, one is the attention, and one is the time. I call it as a EAT. EAT. Essentially in the same order for priority. Time, if you have a time, that doesn't mean that you can give an attention to something. It doesn't mean that you are full of energy so that you can do a productive work. So managing time is only the part of a story. I can be sitting in a meeting, I can be talking to you, but my energies are drained, if my attention is not there, managing time will not yield anything. Then the next level for me goes is the attention. Am I able to pay an attention? And is it worth paying attention to the aspects? And then if there is an attention which is needed also, then the last question which I ask myself is whether do I have an energy to do it? So the energy is the fundamental source. Attention is manifestation and time is something tangible aspect that I see. And that's how I really manage it. And here again, prioritization is one of the big aspects for me. I have to focus on many aspects during the work as well as outside the work. So I use this simple principle of energy, then attention, then time.
Wonderful. I think you've given our listeners a framework that's worth trying and experimenting. Now, this is interesting, right? I also want to touch upon your leadership stint and the process that you're going through at the moment, because I know you love coaching people, mentoring people. Talk to me about how it has evolved for you over these years.
Okay. I will say that the leadership aspect in my career started very early. I joined Bosch in 2009, and somewhere around 2012, I was leading a team. I was a team lead.
Right.
So leadership is something that I have seen very early on. But what is fascinating is that every assignment and every corner and every year brings a newer aspect. And when I say the newer aspect is that sometimes you focus on managing, the topic. Sometimes you focus on managing stakeholders. Sometimes you focus on managing people, manage their expectations, manage their work, and ensure that we are all aligned towards a shared goal and shared vision that we want to drive. Leadership will look like a cacophony if it is not understood well. So that's what I have seen, that when I started this stint, a new stint from the January as a program director, I was pretty much looking that it would be more or less like in a traditional leadership role. But I entered into the role and jumped in, I realized it's much more than the leadership role. It is essentially an entrepreneurial role where I have to do everything as a startup founder need to do, even though we are in the organization. running for, that getting an approvals for hiring in a new people to hiring a new people, ensuring the product visions are there in place, and delivering also. So it's like I can say that janitor to the CEO level, all kind of in a word. It's quite fascinating.
Right. So I want to pick your brain a little bit more and I want to stay on this for a while. One of the things that I find fascinating about leadership is the ability to make these appropriate decisions in order to have a desired outcome, right? I mean, so I wanted to understand, how do you go about anticipating what's coming in the future, and how do you know when to bet on it?
So ultimately, this decisions and aspects that we spend our time, leadership, any kind of a capital, I consider them, all of them, as an investment. I am investing either in people, either in product, either in organization. And this is my view of a leadership. And this is how my decision framework also comes. Let's say I have 100 rupees.
Right.
I can decide to spend now, or I can decide to invest. And on what basis I will do investments. Essentially, it is the return that we see. And along with the return, right, what we see is what is the probability of success. And this is where this combination of these two things goes into the very good decision making. That if I make this decision, what is my probability of success and what is the return it is coming? Sometimes your probability of success is very high, but the return is very less. And those are not the decisions that you really want to take. Sometimes you have the possibility of success is low, but return is so high. That sometimes you take this as a calculated risk decision. So this is how essentially the decisions that I take, which looks into that what is the probability of success and what is the return or the value creation that can happen. And going forward into this, let's say the value creation, that becomes much easier if you just give a little bit of a thought. If I'm successful, what will be the value that will be created? So that is a success aspect, and that is a positive aspect. When we then assess the other aspect, which is the what is the probability of success, we turn around our face 180 degree, and rather than looking at a success, what are the possible failures or what are the possible challenges that come in? And here is where the lot of thinking goes in, by building scenarios, by understanding the intricate details, look at some of the data patterns, and make an informed decision that what is the risk involved in terms of probability of success. So ultimately, all of the risk and everything comes into the probability of success, which is between 0 to 1. And if you don't take a chance, it is guaranteed that it is a 0% of probability of success. But if you take a chance, that probability can materialize. So this is how I I really take a look at all the decisions and I use a rational as well as reasonable aspect both together. And also right. a lot of simple aspects comes in because decisions when we took.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we talk about the returns and all of this thing, which is in one aspect. But that return can also be interpreted in terms of whether I'm developing my team, whether I'm developing in a high performance culture in my team, whether mm-hmm. my teammates are growing or not. So that's how I take an approach. And generally, I spend my lot of time where the, let's say the return is in 2x or 3x or mm-hmm. upwards of that or more than 2x kind of anything. And probability of success is anywhere above 33%, one third chance. It's a good bet to take.
Right, this is getting interesting. I'm now curious to understand because this then begs the question, Manoj, because we are now living in an era where we're developing applications related to artificial intelligence or any other new age application, it requires a lot of room for research, it requires a lot of room for experimentation, and in the end, a lot of data so that we can take that probabilistic decision as you've mentioned. Now, how do you couple that with scale? Because the business needs are, we need to continuously deliver, at least in a quarterly fashion, and we need to scale at the same time because the customer's need is such that it's rapidly changing. How do you manage that?
So, sure. One of the interesting aspects that I have seen is that when we make a decisions,
mm-hmm.
and if our decisions are very, very tight decisions, and we don't have enough slack within the decision making,
right?
We get a lot of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
We work out too much in order to ensure that we realize, and in that right. process we lose out a bigger picture and end up losing the proper and right implementation of decision or also getting the decision because we get sidetracked. So what I have realized over a period of time, it is good to make a decision but ensure that even you have the slack within that decision making. Now I just want to elaborate what I mean by the slack.
Please do.
Yeah. Let's say we have a decision making to do that we want to do a product launch in XYZ day.
Okay.
And based upon the multiple factors and multiple things, we have come up with this muhurta to say that, okay, this is the day that we will launch a product.
Mm.
And we have considered all possible risk scenarios and other things. And we are fairly confident, not certain, but fairly confident that we can reach. On the other side, you say that if you don't make that correction in the product, there is a high chance that the customer will be frustrated with your product, early stage of a product. What is that decision that we have to take in this case? If I say that no, as a leader, I have already announced that this is the product launch and my entire team has to stick to it. It will create a lot of stress, a lot of frustrations, and people will start cutting in a corner. And we will not be able to implement even the product update, which we really want to do. Or correct it, and it might end up frustrating customer more. So what is the best thing to do? My simple decision generally goes is that we have to move the product deadline or the product launch deadline, because what is important is that what we put in hands of our customers, we minimize their frustrations with the early version, because we know for sure that we are not going to give them everything, but what we give them, we should be sure about it. And this is what really matters at the end of a decision making, that what is the flexibility, what is the slack that is available in the decision, and you are able to change sometimes the decisions or the goalpost in the mm-hmm. wake of new reliable information. I think that is the fundamental aspect of any decision making, that all the decisions which you make, they need to be reversible. And mm-hmm. again, reversible, not that day in and day out you flip your decisions, that will also not be the good case, but they have the reversible possibility, and with the new information when it emerges, pretty much think through that what are the consequences and then make the new decision. That's how I will put my case.
I think you fantastically summed it up, and this is exactly where I want to double click a little, because you just didn't talk about data or experimentation, but you also brought in a wonderful aspect of people where you've personally embraced the concept of servant leadership. And not just that, having worked with you closely, I've also understood that you also give a sense of collective ownership to people. Like, where did the inspiration come from and what's the motivation?
So if I go back in time, mm-hmm. if you ask my early team members in the 2014 to 15, They will tell that what, how would you characterize Manoj's leadership? They
Right.
will say essentially highway, my way or highway kind of a leadership, highly autocratic military style, ruthless execution. This was my characteristics in olden
Okay.
time, early days of my leadership. And at that point of time, I always realized that leadership is all about delivering results. And results in terms of a task, in terms of a project, and other things. But something really changed in year 2017-18. And this is in large part thanks to my previous mentor, Mr. Sri Krishnan. He, let me tell the little bit story before I jump into that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So one day I was presenting one of the idea which we have already now realized. So this is 3 years back that I'm talking about the genesis of an AI shield that we are talking. At that time, I just made one presentation to him saying that this is the topic that I think that we should work upon. And this is fantastic. And he listened very carefully, asked us very peculiar questions. I said, I have certain answers for them, but not sure that how it will materialize and everything. That went well. He said, good, I will think through it. This happened in the afternoon around 1 to 2. That was a meeting slot. At 5 o'clock, I get a call from my boss that our super boss has called us into his cabin. And
okay.
I was like, what did I do wrong now? I just finished the presentation. Everything is fine. Within 3 hours, when you're the senior vice president of a company calls you, you have that butterfly feeling.
We're all anxious, right?
We are very anxious because we always fear for the worst, right? We never look for the upside.
Yes.
So I went there, the room, and then along with me, my another colleague, Himajit, was also there. Mohan was my boss and he was there. Shri Krishnan says that you made a presentation. It made me, you know, thinking so much. And I have something for you. And I said, okay. And
okay.
out of nowhere, he takes out one, you know, the page. And hands it over to me and says that, Manoj, congratulations.
Okay.
And I was like dumbfounded that I don't know what to speak because he given me one of the highest recognition within our company called the Shabash Award, which is Platinum Award, just because I made that presentation and made him thinking.
And wow.
This is where the story started, essentially, that when I started realizing that what as a leadership that you need to do. From that point onwards, I realized that as a leader, I need to focus on equal parts onto the tangible results as well as intangible results, which is like developing people, process, culture as well. So I have started focusing on those aspects. And here when I started, I wanted to start very early these things. But then one more thing in the practice that I realized is that to practice this servant leadership, development of a people, you cannot start with day zero. You need people to achieve some amount of maturity. And at the initial days, you have to handhold them and work with them, guide them, mentor them, direct them, and make them to come to the one level from where on you can practice the servant leadership.
Right.
At that point of time, what they are expecting is that somebody is there with them, helping them, guiding them step by step, and then making them realize that how to run. And that is the difference that I have realized, that for servant leadership also to work, you need to also mature your team members, and that is also your responsibility. You cannot simply say that, I cannot simply say that my team, I am practicing servant leadership and my team is not delivering. No, then it is absconding from your responsibility and accountability. So that's how I take a look.
I'm just going to double click on that, you know, the product presentation that you had actually given, right? And let's go back even more further now. How did you go about finding that unaddressed market, especially in the form of AI Shield that you touched upon? And how did you make a decision that it will be an avenue for new businesses and new revenue generation? What was the process like? Can you walk me through that?
So let's say whatever I'm going to give an answer is going to be the answer in the hindsight. So I will try to give an answer in terms of a foresight, that what was my mind state when I did that, what was my thinking, and how it has changed. Because majority of time when we talk about the success, we all get, you know, biased. And this is called survivor bias. The ideas or the people who survive tells the story. And what they tell as a story becomes a kind of a reality. But that is not the case when you are survival, when you are under survival, that's a different story. So I'll tell you from that perspective, and I hope that you as well as the audience will really appreciate it from that point of view. So the story begins very simply, and this is goes back into the let's say the January 2018 when I started my work in Shri Krishna's new division in innovation and incubation. And when I came in, I was told that okay, we have to do the innovation, and I was grappling for 2 to 3 months that what innovation, what topic, how to do, and all of these things. And in one of the conversations, I told that I want to focus on to the advanced computing topic, because computing was always fascinating from me from let's say undergraduate days, and I worked extensively on understanding that what is the meaning of computation and other aspects, and how the technology has evolved. And I started looking into it. When I was looking into it, one of the paper that came to my attention during one of the research is called that how to do the watermarking of neural networks. Like neural networks are the backbone of an AI, and let's say the workforce of an AI. There was this very odd paper which is coming, is that we need to do watermarking of a neural network. And I was like wondering, why do you need to do watermarking of any neural network? What is there in it? It took my curiosity, as well as at the same time, there was like, you know, looking down onto the topic as well, that what these guys are talking. And this was from the IBM. I opened that paper, read into that paper, and I was thoroughly surprised the kind of an insight that that authors have brought in. What they were telling is that if I have developed a neural network, or I have used tons and tons of data, I have deployed my model, and what if that somebody simply, you know, takes out that model? How will I know that this is my model or not? Because you can change one bit here and there within that model, and then your traditional watermarking mechanisms like hashing and all of these things will fail, and you can easily evade that detection, and your model is gone forever. They were telling is that we can leverage the neural plasticity of models and ascertain whether this model belongs to a party or not. And they have given a specific method. This paper got me thinking that, okay, so neural network, we shouldn't look only at as a model, but we should look as an asset. And this is the digital asset, one form of a digital asset. And like how the data is very valuable, the models will be even more valuable because it is in a crystallized insight which is generated out of data, the form of an intelligence. Now the data is in a raw information, then the model is essentially becomes a intelligence. And if data is 1x times valuable, then intelligence will be 10x times valuable. So now this is a new asset class which is highly valuable. And then the question started that how can we protect it? And when I started my journey of looking into the protection, what I realized is that before we think about protecting, let me go and check that how it can be exploited first, right? And from this exploitation journey and this protection thinking is where the genesis of AI security was there. And when I started, I had a very vague feeling that this topic will be very important, because it was aligning to one of the meta pattern which industry always sees in the digital world, right? You create any asset, you create any form of, you know, the communication, applications, or connectivity, anything, and you don't look at the security or anything, and later on security becomes in a prime importance. So security as an afterthought was in a meta pattern, which was there, which was running in the back of my mind. And if now this AI as a digital asset is there, how the same meta pattern can be applied? And this is the genesis, that this is where the two insight which came together to say that, okay, it will be valuable, but I don't know how, when, and by how much. I was not an expert in the field. And so I took my colleague, Himajit, and after working for 2.5 months, we realized, okay, that we have now sufficient thing, and now we should ask other people around us to gather insight that whether it is really valuable, whether it is meaningful or not. We are very highly skeptical, to be honest, and we were seeking the form of a validation that how to validate this thing. At the same time, we were also worried that if this topic could be very interesting and strategic, we might not be able to go outside the organization to do validation. So to solve this dilemma, what we did is we contacted lot of our colleagues who are working in the field of an AI and security and gathered one workshop where we talked about this idea and got their feedbacks and validation. And that's when we really understood, okay, that this topic is so new, it is valuable. And this happened in October. I tried to mature it, but couldn't do anything for the, let's say, the next month, January. And one fine day, he calls me and says that, Manoj, what is update? I was not expecting that he will call me and ask for the update, because that's not generally the norm.
Right.
For the small topic, which we have just had in a two discussions and dialogue,
he exactly.
is now following up. And at that point of time, got really the kick in my stomach that, oh my God, he is following and I have not done anything. Because I never knew that what to do after that. And during that time, very interesting thing happened is that I recruited an intern from Alma Mater Nirmay University. His name was Param. And Param came in and he was working on another project. And I had in a short discussion with him that, Param, I really want to work on this. I don't know what to do. How is your bandwidth? And he said, no, his bandwidth is not there. He's already occupied with another project that was assigned to him. And then by hook or crook, I went back and ensured that he is assigned to this topic. I throw him a two papers saying that, Param, these are the two papers, this is the technique, and this is the broad level of thinking that I have. That's what we can demonstrate. And he, in let's say the next 15-20 days, he cracks that problem of extraction and really demonstrates it. And
wow.
So excited that he was able to demonstrate. I validated it for the next 1 day, and then I just drop an email to the Shri Krishna saying that, Shri Krishna, we have just cracked it and we are able to show you this early result. And you know what was his response? I called him at 11 o'clock. His response is that, Manoj, I'm coming at 1 o'clock at your location, show me.
Okay, this is getting interesting.
We just finished the experimentation. We have not prepared presentations, anything, and he wants to come and see where it was done. Between 11 o'clock to 12:30, me and grab the the A3 size paper, draw the diagrams and all the procedures that we have done onto the the hand drawn thing, stick it onto the wall and make it like an the poster of school going kids, literally with lot of color pencils and other things. And he comes there. And he brings a surprise with him. He brings our managing director, Mr. Vijay Ratna Parke. He is coming into the lab. We have a hand-drawn posters, the situation. And I have an intern who is going to explain that what we have done. I am standing there. And I have a vice president, I have a managing director. And one more surprise is that Bosch Artificial Intelligence India head. So three people on the work we just finished. And we have to present where we don't have all the answers. We are not done diagnostics. We have just shown it.
Right.
They walk in and they say, explain. And we just use that poster to explain everything. We just shown them on the screen that what we are doing, the code is executing, result we have shown, numbers we have shown. And that went beautifully well.
Okay.
It went so well that Vijay was surprised that we were able to do this work. We were able to demonstrate this kind of a thing with the help of an intern. And we took a selfie. So intern was so happy, Param was so happy, he took a selfie with the MD. And he has presented to the MD.
So right.
this gave a lot of the encouragement as well as commitment that was demonstrated in action. Their mere presence was encouragement as well as the commitment. And then after that, everything was going in our favor at many of the time where we have systematically matured this topic again and again by validating that how to exploit the models, how to prove that the exploitation of model is there, measure the exploitations, and then after that see that how we can build the measures to prevent these exploitations and extractions of a model, and which is now matured today as global program for the Bosch, where we are really working at an intersection of AI and security and trying to protect AI models against emerging threats which are coming up. But this was the initial genesis of the story. And what I want your audiences to take it is that nothing is crystal clear. the clarity emerges by experimentations, the systematic approach and the things which you take. And during that time, we had lots of ups and downs. We have kept our faith that there will be something. And we were very open in terms of, that how do we want to progress?
Mm-hmm.
This is essentially the nature of innovations, which is always emerging. And it is driven from data as well as your experiences from need of our customers and other aspects. Now, what I have not covered in this story is the customer angle.
Right.
This is also the important aspect that I just want to tell, that what we did after this initial part, that we know that the technology works, mm-hmm. we know that the problem exists. We systematically went to talk to more than 50 people, mm-hmm. including inside organization and outside organizations, to validate what is the need of this, is there a need, first of all, in the market, or is this problem really a valid problem for them? And what we realize is that this problem was futuristic, which is generally the case for any time when you do the, the push of a technology into the market.
Right.
Right. So when the AI started a long time back, it was the technology. And today we have a huge traction because there is a customer demand on the other side. Mm-hmm. We realized in the AI, this AI security aspect also, that this is going to be the technology push to begin with. So with all of this 50 interviews, what we have realized is that we need to build, first of all, an awareness about this topic. And once the mm-hmm. organizations and people and users are aware about this, I think the need will emerge automatically. And this was the contradictory learning that we have from the traditional wisdom, is that you go and first, if there is a problem of a customer, then you solve it. But that is essentially is that either the problem exists today or problem was in the past.
Mm-hmm.
What about the anticipatory problems in the future? And we were operating in this zone of an anticipatory problem, where we need to build a technology and make the technology ready when that problem arises. And this gave us a good headway also in terms of that, yes, how much timeline that we have in order to build the technology, mature the technology. Because technology was in very nascent state. You can very much close it. It is kind of in a research domain.
Right.
And how to mature research to technology to the product, it gave us a little bit of an understanding by doing a lot of customer interactions at the beginning. And after that, we have ensured that at every, every opportunity that we have to talk to customers, we talk about this problem, we gather the insight, and we make necessary changes. In our last, this year, in March, when we did some early user trials and customer trials, we realized that how the product should evolve. And that has fed into our product roadmap as a whole. So the customer engagement is good, but you need to understand that what kind of an engagement and what kind of an probable insights that you will gather mm-hmm. if the problem is not faced today or in the past by customers. So this is something new that I have learned.
Right. So I now want to get to the most important part of this segment, which is about pricing. And as product teams, we all face this conundrum, which is when you're planning your product market fit or go to market strategy, you will be asked, is there real money attached to it? Will people buy the solution? And how quickly are you expecting to generate revenue? How do you go about tackling those situations?
So, Sharad, this question gets asked many of times. And
yes.
I think you have also faced it, and I have faced enough times. What I really see is not the questions, but what is the intent behind that question? Are they asking the questions to gauge whether there is a pricing involved and what is the cost that they have to pay for this getting the solution? Or the perspective is that I don't really understand your value propositions. I don't understand what problem you are talking. Or this is just a one more way to get that answer out and make my understanding clear as a customer when they ask this question.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very important that when they ask this question, to apply your own judgment and see that where they are coming from, this question. Because this question is just tip of the iceberg, right? So pricing is essentially can happen. One is that either you have understood the value,
mm-hmm.
and you want to gauge that how much you will have to pay to get that value, or because I have not understood the value, I will use mm-hmm. the price as an proxy of what is the value.
Wow, okay.
And if people are using price as a proxy for the value, then essentially we have to circle back and make them understand what is the probability that I will face this problem in the future. This becomes a little difficult thing, because this again is another, let's say, the mechanism by which you understand that customer has yet not understood that this could cause a serious harm. I'll give you the very simple example. When somebody calls you to sell the insurance, you ask, what do you ask him? What is the price first?
What is the price? What benefits do I get? How much is it covered?
Yeah. But what is going on in your mind actually?
Can I protect my family with it? Can I protect myself with it?
And when you say, can I protect it? What mm-hmm. is the underlying connotation? You are already started thinking that what is the probability that something has gone wrong?
Correct.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. then you attach that, you know, in your mind without even your knowledge, you attach that probability of something mm-hmm. is going wrong or something problem emerging in the future. And mm-hmm. you arrive in your mind at some number that, okay, this is the rough number that mm-hmm. is there, the value at risk in future. And for that value at risk in future, it is okay to pay this much of a premium.
Ah, okay. Okay. I think that's an interesting viewpoint that you made.
I wanted to just give you this example to bring out all of these different facets of that. Mm-hmm. When the customer asks this question, what actually runs in their mind? And this is the most important aspect, that as a pricing or the product aspect, right, we develop a deeper understanding of the customers, their ecosystems, and what are their dominant thinking patterns which are coming up. Might not apply in all the cases, but if you have cracked in general the majority of the thinking process, you will realize that that is really helpful. So now bringing to the question, bringing to the scenario of the same mm-hmm. insurance guy who has called you and he says that, Sharad, the premium is monthly 1 lakh rupees. You will simply say, thank you, and you will put down the phone.
Yes.
You say the same thing that, Sharad, the premium is monthly, you know, is only 200 rupees.
Right.
And then you will see that 200 is okay. The risk, which is high, benefits are this. And that, mm-hmm. then you are ready to pay. So now here also is very interesting aspects that you are gauging. Pricing and the value creations. You cannot extract all the value that you have created for your customers. You have to leave something on the table where they feel that, okay, they are getting in a bargain. And this is where the real aspect comes, that what is that value creation is in the mind of a customer. If the customer is very, let's say, a very anxious and not so sure about what he wants, he or she will estimate the value at risk is very high or very low. And if they estimate very high, then you can also match that by extracting more value from them. But that is not sustainable. That is called exploitation in that case.
Right.
If they value too less, you will have a missed opportunities from them. What is interesting is that we understand what is the general value creation that we have, and try mm-hmm. to leave something on the table, not something, but majority chunk in the table for customer. Simply is that if I am paying a 10 rupees for any service or any product, I am expecting at least 2 to 3x of a return for myself. If you or your product can generate 20 or 30 rupees for me, I am willing to share 10 rupees with you, which is the price of a product. With all of this, what I'm trying to tell you is, at the end of the day, is that if the customer is asking for the price, and if this is the value creation or the value proposition, how much, if they are not clear about that, and if you guess that, you have to go and attack that part and make them understand and realize that what is the value creation for them. And therefore, this price is justified. And this is where majority of our conversation falls in. On the other hand, when the people are fairly clear about what mm-hmm. is the value, it is there, and it is in a need for them, they want to know the price to just make a decision. Am I really going to extract that value or not? And is it worth paying for this? If you already know that my product or solution will create 50 or 60 rupees for you,
mm-hmm.
and then you say that my product price is 100 rupees, that person will say no. So they just want to know this, that where your price point lies, which
right.
is their willingness to pay, and what is the value creation for them. So essentially with this simple framework, what happens mm-hmm. is that you need to understand what is the customer's mindset, why they are asking these questions. And answers can differ. So understanding this process, understanding their context and their thinking process helps us to give us a right answer, to arrive at a right decision, which is mutually beneficial and not, exploiting on any of the parties at the end of the day.
Right. So I want to end the show with almost like a pop quiz question. And I want to pick your brain to try and understand what your thoughts are. Who do you think will sustain and win in the long term? Great business leaders with a mediocre product or mediocre people with a great product?
First one.
I thoroughly enjoyed the overall discussion, Manoj. I think we don't get enough time like this on a daily basis. So I really enjoyed picking your brain on some of the topics that I was curious on. And it was really, itching me to ask you these questions and get your thoughts on these topics. So thank you so much. Any last words that you want to tell our listeners at the moment?
So thank you for that. And I wanted audience just to understand that mm-hmm. you are also the core member of our team. And even though you have started late in our journey,
right,
you are already contributing. And that speaks a lot about the team as well as the topic. And that is the final thought that I want audience to live with, is that
mm-hmm.
when you have the great purpose,
mm-hmm.
which is like us, our purpose is, to secure the AI for the world. And
absolutely.
When you have any great colleagues, Sharath, including you with all of our team members,
mm-hmm.
the environment which gets created is so, euphoric
mm-hmm.
As well as challenging, that you know that you really want to be part of it and you really want to contribute. Because sometimes we get an opportunity where we can really put a dent in the mm-hmm. universe, as Steve Jobs has said.
Absolutely.
And I think here is where we have all found our opportunity to put a dent in the universe. And we also found Ikigai for us. So I think that that Ikigai framework also fits in very well for the entire team here. And that is what is driving. And ultimately is the people in today's mm-hmm. world and their intellectual capability is what drives the growth. Be it a product, be it an organization, be it personal growth. But in all this journey, what we don't have to forget is that people are at the core of it. That's my final thought, Sharad. Really enjoyed talking to you. It's after a long time I am talking about this journey, and probably only the second time. So it was a good jog down the memory lane. My heart were beating. Again, there were some, the butterflies in the stomach.
Right.
But that is the gripping part of this story.
Thank you so much, Manoj, for gracing the show and dropping these little nuggets of wisdom. And I'm pretty sure that whomsoever wants to apply it, it just applies in spades, right? So thank you once again. I thoroughly enjoyed the show. To all the listeners out there, if you did enjoy the conversation, please, please, please subscribe to the show and also spread it amongst your circle so that you can let the distribution algorithms know that you are enjoying these shows.